Many of you know that I was a teenage fundamentalist. I grew up in a super liberal church, United Church of Canada. And my way of rebelling as a teen, of course, was to head in the other direction. Liberal, so I became very, very conservative. Well, a staple of youth ministry at that time was having guest bands for evening worship services. It's pretty common now in churches to walk in and see guitars and drum sets in the sanctuary, but back in the 70s, those were fighting words. One evening, a local band played for our district youth in the basement of our church. I fell in love with the band, their music, their theology. I bought all of their cassette tapes. Remember cassette tapes? Well, the title song on the tape was "Your Redemption Draweth Nigh." You can still find some really awful versions of it on YouTube. The redemption the song refers to is the second coming. The signs of the times are everywhere, and Jesus is coming back soon, which was a huge thing in the 70s. Not such a big thing now, but in the 70s it was a big deal that Jesus was coming back. And while I know that the adorable lead singer in the band had something to do with my fascination with this band and with the song, I like to think that there was something more going on. The Sunday morning church upstairs was all about Norman Vincent Peale and self-help and three ways to better your life. The underlying theme of the sermons was, you know what, it's really pretty much up to you. But the church downstairs in the basement, they were saying that you can be connected to something greater and wiser and deeper, that in the future there's not just improvement of character, but the possibility of being made new, being part of something bigger than awkward, gawky, teenaged me. You know, if you actually read the Bible, and surprisingly few people have actually read the Bible, it has little to say about a redemption that is way off somewhere in the future in some place like heaven, or that magically arrives when Jesus appears in Salt Lake City or wherever his latest destination is booked. Redemption in the Bible is generally not about an afterlife, which I know is disappointing because this is what we expect the Bible to say. For example, in the passage that we read from Isaiah today, and as I listened to it again, I realize there are all kinds of problems and issues in that passage, right? If we can just set those aside and focus on the good parts this morning, okay? In that passage, redemption is clearly something happening now. Don't fear, God says, because I have redeemed you. I have redeemed you. It's already happened. And when you and I hear these words, these positive, affirmative words in Isaiah, they sound wonderful to our ears. You are mine, I will be with you, I've called you by name. They remind us of baptism. That's why they're on this Sunday. But picture Israel hearing these words from Isaiah. They're in exile. They've been uprooted from their homes. They are far from everything that they are familiar with. And God says, I have redeemed you. Land has been laid waste, and you're saying to us, I have redeemed you? If this is true, then why does all of this awful stuff keep on happening? All of which begs the question, what does it mean to be redeemed? When you have a coupon and you take it to the store, this doesn't happen very often now, but it happens sometimes, you take it to the store to redeem it, you don't walk away. You get something else in its place. When we speak of a period of time being redeemed, we mean that what appeared from one perspective to be a complete loss now makes sense, now has a positive redeeming value for us. When we are redeemed, surely it has something of that same meaning, that we are being redeemed. restored, that we are being renewed from within. When God promises redemption in the Bible, I think our first thought is about rescue from a really bad situation. That's kind of what Isaiah is talking about. Sometimes it is that. But redemption is almost always about something more. It's deliverance from the power of fear, even when the outward circumstances haven't changed. It's crossing the threshold into a new kind of life, free from the need to attach ourselves to the latest idol, even when the idols are glittering all around us. Redemption is the gift of a new way of seeing or a new way of acting when what you've always done has caused nothing but pain. Redemption is being open to change as individuals, as communities of faith. Change that previously might have seemed terrifying, but now seems for some reason to be kind of inviting and somewhat obvious. Redemption is being centered. It's being reconnected to the center of all things, to God, and discovering that we are about so much more than the ridiculous things that we were worried about right before we came in to worship. All of which brings us to baptism. Isn't this why we baptize babies? I mean, we can truly do all kinds of things to celebrate a new life, and we do, with naming rituals and food and party hats and confetti cannons and balloons. But we bring babies here to the font, which hasn't gone missing. It's actually out in the north foyer so that everybody would notice the font. And we make promises at that font, which, if we are completely honest, those promises will be hard to keep. And then we pour water on their sweet little heads, and some of them cry, despite our best pastoral baby wrangling skills. Why? Why do we do this? Because we want to connect our children to the source of life, to the ground of being. We want them to belong to something bigger than just getting ahead and getting a cool job and getting a nice house in Pemberton Heights and driving a cool Mustang and having 1,000 Facebook friends. We want them to be connected to that larger sacred narrative, parts of which we read during the baptism ceremony, the story that God hasn't given up on us, that God is still working through us, through misfits like you and me, to save and heal the world. And when those baptismal waters touch their heads, they touch our heads this morning, we are reconnected with the source of life. We are anointed for what we were created for joy, for love, for peace. Rachel Held Evans, in her lovely book, Searching for Sunday, narrates an all too familiar story. She met Andrew, a college freshman, at a conference where she was teaching. And he wanted to tell her about his upcoming baptism. Rachel said she'd never met anyone more excited than Andrew to be baptized. "I honestly thought I would never get baptized," he said. He showed her a picture on his phone of the church that he grew up in, and on the website there was a newsletter article written by Andrew's father, who was the pastor of the church. The article was about same-sex relationships, which his dad described in the article as, quote, "sickening." Andrew said he wrote that newsletter article right after I came out. The last time Andrew spoke with his father, he told Andrew that he was going to hell. Somehow, Andrew found a new church. I mean, many of us would have given up on churches. But he found one that accepted him as he was, maybe in church like this one. And his new faith community arranged for him to be baptized. You know, hearing Andrew's story is like cold water splashing on my face. For every teen like me who was accepted and loved and given leadership responsibilities, there are teens just like Andrew who are strangers in their own who are strangers in the pews of their home churches. Andrew said he put off baptism because he thought he wasn't good enough to be baptized. But then I realized, he said, that baptism is done at the beginning of your faith journey. We baptize babies, right? I mean, what have babies done other than smile and poop, right? And eat. You don't have to have everything together to be baptized, he said. You just have to grasp God's grace. God's grace is enough. One of the things that struck me about Jesus' baptism, as Luke tells it, is that Jesus simply got in line. The spotlight didn't come up as Jesus approached John in the heavenly choir and the announcer's voice. That came a little bit later. And now, from Nazareth, he just got in line with the misfits and the unwashed. He was baptized, Luke says, with everyone else. He got in line with everyone worn out by the fear and the terror of those times. He got in line with broken people who were longing for a fresh start, who had given up on everything, even given up on God. So will you get in line with Jesus? Will you get in line to stand with folks like Andrew, who have lost hope, who are desperate for grace? Will you get in line and receive those life-giving words, "I will be with you. I've called you by name. You are mine. You are precious in my sight." And most of all, will you become that life-giving word? Not just for the ones who are here,